That agency is now, at least when I left, from the process of approaching 100 employees and had over a $30 million budget. I'd like to comment further on a couple of things that you said, Mike, that the Mandatory Borough Act, I think, did squelch a whole lot of government initiatives with respect to furthering the local government article in our state. I think it had a very serious, long-term inhibiting effect, at least within the executive branch, on executive kinds of initiatives with respect to dealing with local government in our state. And I think, in fact, that is demonstrated amply when you look at the budget of the local affairs agency and the creation of the department, and also the total lack of initiative taken by the legislature in the local government area. This is something to shy away from. Another observation, if I might briefly, I've always felt, as you mentioned also, the local government article said, maximum local government, the liberal construction to get the local government article. And I can recall being in the state cabinet and having Anchorage legislators beating on my door, urging me to take state executive action to unify Anchorage during years of turmoil that was undergone. My response consistently being, this is a local issue, we're helping any way we can. By God, you people are on the decision, the mandate of the state. With respect to urban governments, I think that I agree with the comment that Ben Marr said, unification of the local government structure in the future, at least in keeping with the intent and purpose of the state constitution. But the huge issue that has dominated local government development in our state, outside of the urban arena, has been what do you do about the rural area of our state, the unorganized rural. And also, there's been a lot of study done and tentative steps taken from time to time. I'd just like to say that I'm very intrigued by the proposition that Mr. Harper puts forth, and I think it's very much in keeping with the intent of the discussion of this kind, and I'd like to pursue it further during the course of this meeting. Are there any questions or comments from Mr. Harper, myself, or anybody at this time? If not, I'd like to ask Mayor Evan Hobson to present his comments at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I merely want to point out that the provision in the Constitution providing for local government has been a very important section. I think both with respect to the organized boroughs, they were organized under the Mandatory Borough Act, and those that voluntarily organized, we have tried both the different classes of boroughs and to include an organized home rule borough. From the experiences that I've had, and I assisted organizing the North Slope Borough, we took a very broad view of the existing provision, and as you well know, we organized the largest single municipal government in the world. It covers something like 88,000 square miles. But this was the way in the North Slope Borough that we saw was a tremendous tax base to provide for the needs of the total area. We are now a home rule borough, and having organized, we did go through some very serious and growing pains, but up to this point, the biggest problems that we've had so far are not caused by this section, local government section in the Constitution. We are having some problems implementing the section in the statute. I think that's something that any organized municipal government faces, but I merely want to point out that this section in the Constitution is a very workable section, and I think we ought to thank the foresight and the intelligence of the original Constitution convention members for having put into this Constitution a very worthwhile provision in the Constitution. Tim and I, unless there are a few questions that we might further on a home rule for any problems up there after the last question and comment. Thank you.
Are there any questions or comments? I'd like to do you want to come up here and speak to the microphone, please, so you can get it on tape?
I'd like to ask Mr. Hobson if he's experienced any growing pains that Mr. Marsh talked about earlier with a first-class city inside the borough. Could you reflect on the relationship that your home rule borough has had with either first or second-class city?
We had 8 communities in the borough at the time we organized, one of which we had one first-class city within the borough. All the others were then second-class cities, which normally originally referred to as fourth-class cities, but they were reclassified several years ago. We did have some problems with respect to the relationship between the first-class city of Farrow and the borough. At the time we incorporated, the borough was given 3 area-wide powers, to which the city lost immediately at the time the incorporation vote took place. We were given the authority to operate all of the schools within the North Slope. We were given the taxing power and the power to collect taxes. And we also were given the power planning, planning, and that particular power from the city to which the city of Barrow lost. It did lose its revenue sharing that it was getting from the state on account of the power being transferred to the borough at the time we incorporated. But I probably should also point out that during the 4 years we have been organized, the assembly took the attitude that the borough must provide additional services to all of our communities. So of the 21 powers enumerated in Title 29, we have, by vote of the people, transferred 13 of those service-producing powers to the borough, so that our tax base applies more even across the board towards providing services to the rest of our community. We are now beginning to talk informally about taking into consideration the various things that the large department about. We are beginning to discuss possibilities of unified government at this point.
Kind of question of history now. The North Slope Borough is, of course, fully established and for all visible purposes, a very viable unit of local government. But during the time that the question was before the state, the local data commission, and my agency, for the creation of North Slope Borough, as Kevin said, comprised the entire North Slope Borough, so maybe 8,000 square miles. One of the strong arguments being made in opposition to the North Slope Borough was that sheer size violated the intent of the framers of the Constitution. That at no time had members of the Constitution envisioned the local government units of this sheer size. And I'm, you may not choose to comment, but I'm wondering, Jim, whether you might, or Mr. Lombard, whether you might care to comment on that observation that, that was raised at the time also for under consideration.
I would think, as I recall, you can check me on this, Jim, that we did envision the possibility of large buildings. If this were not the case, then I think we would have tried to write in that a borough shall be only so many square miles. And there again, that would be denying posterity the right to set boundaries. And I think our intent was just to give a basic framework. And you'll notice in a number of the articles, as provided by law, leaving it up to succeeding legislators to make the decisions that would be necessary. So, as I recall, I don't think we thought that boroughs had to be this small. In fact, that was the reason for them, to prevent this matter of the old city and then the county being the rest of the state, all divided up into counties. And to prevent that would be to at least make the allowance for this. It's interesting to hear what's happened in Anchorage in the 20 years and what's happened in the North Slope. If I could ask a question to you, Mr. Lott, coming from another part of the state, a small town that's quite isolated, how do you find your home rule has fit in within the framework of the Constitution? I think 25, close to 30 years ago, they're even they even incorporated under the territorial legislature, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, that, right. But I'm just curious, we've heard from the big city of Anchorage and the North Slope and how Yakutat has fit into the whole local government picture.
I think the concern, the built-in conflict of the local government article creating entirely new units of local government, its purpose was to supplant the existing units geographically limited units of local government, created the conflict, caused for the conflict of local government in the last over the years. Certainly, the frame has built a mechanism to overcome it, which is a very strong issue at the local level. And that's a preface to, you know, also I've had experience in state government and federal government living in Yakutat. You know, that's become your governmental reference. And suddenly you find yourself even to the point of becoming paranoid about the imposition of, you know, another layer of government that would remove from you, you know, prerogatives that you enjoy at the present time in which you may choose to expand upon. And I found in the Yakutat, for example, the present time where we're undergoing a very close examination of our local government structure and its real ability to grow and expand because of the emerging oil development, a real fear that some other form of government may be imposed which would deny, you know, the existing form of local government. So we'll probably go through the very throes that all of the other local
have
gone to if the
girls can come to
them. We're
the same paranoia. As far as the size of roads is concerned, I agree with Min and Lombard in that Vic Fisher had a pat phrase for it, and I can't quote it, but it was to encompass an area that would be socio-economic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you have a lot of long, high-sounding words in it, but what it meant was that mountains, though you may think of them as barriers, would be no barriers. Rivers would be no barriers. The borough could be as large or as small as the people within that area wanted it to be. I will be honest to say I don't think it would be seen if somebody like Hobson would come along and try to come all of Alaska, but the concept of a large borough certainly was there in the minds of the delegates at the time. One of the things about this local government, it had a great deal of influence on this local government. Local boundary, whatever it is, had a great deal of influence from John Bebach, and he was the one that guided this in many respects, having studied and experienced many of the ills that beset the local government areas in the rule of 48. And he continually exhorted us to, in writing the local government article, to make sure that there was no legislation written into the article, to make it as broad and as flexible an article as at all possible, to leave the legislation entirely up to the legislature that would come along after this was done. I think it was the right advice and the right decision to make at that time.
Certainly the question besides the most of it is not an overriding one during the course of this consideration that we've been treating this meeting. Are there any comments or questions?
Byron, of the nine boroughs that exist in the state of Alaska today, those nine boroughs actually cover probably the lesser amount of the total territory, and I'm not sure exactly how much it is, but the boroughs have different characteristics. For instance, Bristol Bay Borough and Kenai Peninsula Borough have boroughs in which you have a number of different population centers, whereas Anchorage Borough was a clear-cut type of borough with one urban center and a rural hinterland, which subsequently became an urban hinterland. At least in Anchorage Borough, we have a road network, and the most furthest distance member of the assembly lives 25 miles from the seat of government. But in Kenai Borough, they have to fly in. When they have a meeting, they've got 17 members on the assembly, and they have to fly in to have a meeting. I can't imagine what it's like in North Fork Borough. They must have to start a week before. I don't know. But those are probably minor difficulties. They certainly, in the case of Kenai Borough and Nyamuska Borough, Bristol Bay Borough, those urban-rural distinctions are blurred. They don't have the same impact they have in a borough like Fairbanks or Anchorage. I think that I don't know that the same progression would occur in those. In comment on your other thing, though, I would say that that all the boroughs are probably concerned with whether somebody's going to move in locally and take over powers, exercise authority. For example, the coastal zone management issue is a serious issue. And both Yakutat and Anchorage are concerned that maybe the state's going to tell them how to plan their coastal zone area.
My paranoia is
showing
too when I say that I see some elements of that. Mr. Hart's plan for the
owner. Evan, did you wish to comment? I just wanted to point out that we have a seven-member assembly, and we also have one, the whole borough is one election district. During the last 2 years, we've had a member on the assembly from Wainwright. We also had for 2 years a member from Kaktovik, my island. Presently, after last week's election, we ended up with all seven members of the borough coming from Barrow. Where we don't have any representation now from any other community. They all come from the Barrow area.
Cool. We had a joint meeting with Kenai Borough here about a month ago. Anchorage is starting to try to generate some interest in joint meetings with the surrounding boroughs on issues of common ground, such as zone management, air pollution, and things of that nature. And I noted with interest that the 17-member assembly in Kenai, being rather difficult to get together, they also have the weighted vote thing, which is a further complication. I think they have a total of 103 5/8 votes on their assembly. And they have representation from all five of their cities and from their various other areas as well, and their non-city areas. And as a result, every member of the assembly has a different weight when he votes. And for instance, one guy says that he has 10 7/8 votes when he votes. That means that every time a vote is taken, they have to use a calculator to figure out what the, you know, who won. That's interesting.
Thank you, Ben. At this time, I'd like to ask Lee Sharp, the legal counsel for the City of Burns General, to make this presentation.
Thank you, Byron. Seems to be an awful lot of praise for the work that the Committee on Local Government did, and I can't do anything but join them. A lot of the credit, not to distract from the committee, I think goes to John Bedell, the advisor from Public Administration Services that the Constitutional Fathers had foresight enough, or the state had, excuse me, the territory had foresight enough to retain. I think it's already been stated that one of the things that the local government committee thought to do was really to avoid the mistakes that had occurred elsewhere. And that was one of their foremost goals, to find out what the problems were elsewhere and then provide for a system that would avoid those problems. And that's one of the reasons that they have set out this, in the purpose section, that is to provide a maximum amount of local government with a minimum number of local government units. They go to the very next section, and section 2, and there they begin implementing that goal. They provide that local government power should be vested, that is, all local government power should be vested in boroughs and cities. This spelled the demise of the public utility districts as they existed, school districts, and so forth. In fact, I understand that there were even some, in reading the minutes and discussing the subject with some of the members of the committee, that there was even some feeling that school districts should be, that their function should be minimized as much as possible, that is, it should be integrated into this new borough government. They didn't go quite that far. There was also some discussion at one time of dissolving cities. That, I think, was probably realized was politically unpalatable. But it was the type of thinking that I think John got them in the train of, from the fact that, I think Portland, Oregon, I think right now, the area down there has about 400 overlapping taxing districts. And what the gentleman here who was following political science matters a little more closely than I am, perhaps correct me on that number, there's just a staggering number of these independent, overlapping taxing jurisdictions. And this is what our people wanted to avoid. I think they did an excellent job of it. The mechanism that they used for that was a service area. That is, there's going to be, they recognize that these districts are formed for, among other things, providing a delivery of services on a differential level. That is, if you're an organized city, you provide full services. A rural area may not need full services. Obviously, it doesn't. You need some mechanism to deliver those services to the rural areas, to the areas that actually need them, without fully incorporating. The mechanism that came about in the lower 48 was special service districts. Special service districts would have taxing power, it would have a governing board, most of whom nobody knew, because there were so many of them. You went to the polls, you might have 15 different boards that you were voting for. So we did manage to avoid all that in Alaska. But going back to section 2, all local government power shall be vested in boroughs and cities. When I first looked at this, I thought, aha, this is a limitation that prevents a number of these special taxing districts from springing up. That also has the effect of those emasculating school districts. They may no longer exercise local government powers, in particular, and may no longer levy taxes. Then you look at it again, and it can also be read as a grant. All local government powers shall be vested in boroughs and cities. Now, this is something that, to my knowledge, no one has really pursued. I'm waiting for some borough to come along and say, gee, under Section 2, we're an organized borough, and we have all local government powers. I don't know how far that's going to go, because I think that is essentially the purpose of Section 2 is to limit, rather than to act as a grant. But there's certainly that possibility there. A question that I throw out, but, good friend Jim Nordale, who's back here with us, borough attorney from North Star Borough, has asked is, what is a unified municipal government? If all local government has to be in cities or boroughs, what's a unified government? Is it a city or is it a borough? It must be one or the other of these animals. I don't know that anybody's going to take that to the court, but it could provide some problems with unified local government. If there is a constitutional convention, I think that perhaps some cosmetic amendments might be made to that or considered for that particular article or section in order to get to that rather than intriguing the question. Service areas, as I say, I think are the real key to the fine form of local government we have up here. But I have a couple of questions on that section also. It seems that the way the section reads is that you don't form a service area if you can use some other mechanism. If you can annex, fine. Problem with annexation, as Ben pointed out, is that you have to provide the full level of services when you annex. That new area is entitled to those because you're going to be taxing at the full rate. There's been some proposals for step annexation to overcome this, but nevertheless, ultimately, within a relatively short period of time, that newly annexed area has to be receiving a full level of services, a full complement of municipal services, just like everybody else in the city. Maybe the area just isn't going to be ready for that. So maybe annexation really isn't the answer. Another thing that they require that you investigate is whether an existing service area can provide it. I think what they fail, perhaps they're talking about expanding an existing service area. If that's the case, there's no problem. One way or another, you're going to have to create that service area in order to have the definition of the area in which you're going to levy the additional tax to provide that service. And the other alternate that you're supposed to examine, and this is the one that I have the greatest criticism of, and that's incorporation as a city. Now, I just don't see how that fits with Section 2, that we're to have a minimum number of local government units. A service area is not a local government unit. It's merely an administrative unit. At least my view of it is an administrative unit. It has no independent governing body. The most it might ever have is an advisory board. It has no powers. The assembly still has all the local government powers. It forms a unit, describes the services that are to be performed, levies the taxes that are necessary. There may be a referendum, depending on what sort of procedure you're using to run it, but nevertheless, the control of that service area remains in the hands of the borough assembly. I'm really wondering why we're encouraging the creation of additional cities. When probably it's an additional local governmental unit. So, if there's a convention, I would certainly suggest that they examine that, perhaps clarify the function of the service area. There have been, I think, in the Anchorage area right now, there's a problem on bonding for a service area. The problem arose because the election district did not happen to coincide with the service area. And apparently they did not ensure that those who voted on the bond election within that service area or only those within the service area because of the two overlapping election districts. But in spite of this, I think the service area is probably one of the most flexible tools we have. I think it's also been the key to the success of unification. I really don't think there could have been a unification, successful unification move in any of these boroughs that have done so to date without this service area mechanism. Something has to be provided for the continuation of the existing city, unless you're in such a small area that you can spread all your services area-wide. We know that in Juneau, for instance, you just don't need the full complement of municipal services 30 miles out the road because there's just not that many people. It'd be prohibitively expensive to provide them out there. So in some way, still identifying the various areas that are going to receive differential services upon which you want to levy differential taxes, portions of those services. I think we have to face the fact that in any sort of, when you impose a new government, governmental unit on any area, you're going to have parochialism. The city of Juneau continues to have an identity. The city of Douglas continues to have an identity. I should say the former city of Juneau, former city of Douglas, continue to have identity. The Auk Bay area has an identity, which it hasn't lost yet. The Mendenhall Valley is really probably too new phenomena to have that firm an identity, but it's certainly a growing identity. These areas retain that identity through the service area mechanism, the last vestige, I suppose, of their identity. Juneau and Douglas have each become service areas. They're given numbers, but they will be tied to the person who calls Douglas service area number two. It's a little bit too demeaning. So they do continue their own self-identity through this mechanism of the service area. The area that I have most of my concern with is the one on home rule. As pointed out, Mr. DeBout and his cohorts encouraged a rather broad approach to the powers of local government. I certainly stand corrected if I'm wrong, John, but I believe that DeBout suggested what is known as the Fordham or the AMA model for home rule. In that particular model, there is a grant, rather general grant of powers to a home rule municipality. Then there's a withdrawal of specific powers. They may not act in matters creating civil law. They may not act to define felonies. Then the model goes on, and there are specific areas which the home rule municipality has exclusive authority. That is, the legislature may not interfere. Mr. DeBout was also successful in pointing out the problems that other states were having with their own forms of home rule. Home rule came about back in the middle 19th century in St. Louis. St. Louis had finally gotten tired of the legislature interfering with its internal affairs and managed to get a constitutional amendment. It allowed them to adopt a charter for their own internal working. That charter couldn't be in conflict or inconsistent with anything in the Constitution or the laws of the state. So they gave with one hand and they took away with the other. But the court there finally said, now wait a minute, obviously they were to have been given something. They were to have been given some sort of local autonomy, some protected sphere of influence in which the legislature could not encroach. So having created this, then the courts begin to define it. Other states followed suit, and California, I believe, was one of the next ones that adopted a home rule provision. And theirs was couched in terms of exclusive autonomy or authority in local affairs. sort of sprang into being what was known as the local affairs test, the local activities rule, state-local test. This is what the court applied to determine whether a municipality, a home rule municipality, had any sort of exclusive jurisdiction. It was a very flexible test, and I think home rule municipalities decided things weren't really working out very well. They'd gotten the legislature out of some of their functioning, but it turned out that the courts kind of turned on them and began slicing into that and giving it back to the legislature. With this in mind, and with our committee fully aware of this, they thought to avoid this problem, and they drafted an extremely simple and broad grant of home rule power. And that is that a home rule borough or city may exercise all legislative powers not prohibited by law or charter. So the only thing we have to find out now is what's prohibited by law or charter. To be noted that it's the adoption of the charter which then casts upon the home rule municipality all legislative powers which are not prohibited. You don't have to look around and see what's been given you. It's also interesting to note that there's no sphere of exclusive, if the home rule municipality is not protected from legislative incursion. And what our people saw was a problem that existed with the courts. And they thought that the courts were not the appropriate vehicle for dividing political powers. That should be up to the people or the legislature. And that's why they put this in these terms, that you have all legislative powers not prohibited by law or by charter. In other words, the legislature is going to have to act to take something away from you if you're a home rule municipality. The presumption is you've got everything you need, and perhaps even more. I think John recognized the problem with this rather broad grant, which went beyond anything he had recommended. The CAS came out with recommendations after the convention. There were recommendations to the new state as to what they should do to implement the Constitution. And he recommended that the legislature take some immediate steps to limit home rule power. He suggested, as I recall, that they enact something that sounded like the AMA model on limitations, that is, that home rule municipalities could not enact civil law and they could not define felonies. The legislature never did that. So the question still remains, what's prohibited? Well, Title 29 prohibits a number of things, but how do the courts determine what's prohibited? There was a lot of talk in the committee, the local government committee meeting, about specifically being prohibited. That is not just a general prohibition, but the only things that would be prohibited were those things that were specifically prohibited by law. And I know Vic Fisher take this posture, and that is that the legislature has to be very specific about this prohibition. Well, this question has gone to our Supreme Court, and they said, no, that's unworkable. We can't expect the legislature to engage in that sort of fall to raw every time they have a bill before them. So we're going to look around and see what prohibited really means. I should state that about the first three Supreme Court decisions that came out on home rule were pretty much in line with the interpretation I think the most attorneys had of the and of the committee had of this home rule act. That is, it was very broad, essentially unlimited, unless specific limitations were found. Then the City of Anchorage and the Two Gas Electric Company got into a little flap about who was going to serve the bowling alley. Two Gas of the city with electricity. The city denied a building permit which would have allowed Two Gas to serve, and they wanted to serve them themselves. The case finally went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in what I can only describe as an outrageous opinion, I think it outraged just about every municipal attorney who read it. I wasn't a municipal attorney at that time, said, see, we'll look around at the other states to see what they've got for home rule as a guide for how we deal with a conflict between a statute and an ordinance. They had to work to find a conflict, but they found a conflict. And so now we found this conflict, we're going to have to see how to deal with it. And see how we deal with it, we'll just look at the other states. And lo and behold, they looked precisely the states which Mr. Rubel had taken to the committee and said, these are examples of what you want to avoid. And our court said, well, this is what everybody else is doing. They have this local activities rule. And it looks good to us. Therefore, as a matter of expediency, we will adopt this local activities rule. If it's something that's a matter of local concern, then we'll presume that the city could have the power to act. If there's state concern in it, then the state act is going to have to prevail. And they said if there's any reasonable doubt, it will be resolved in favor of the state act. Now, for those who have a little bit of law, or have been around municipalities, heard of Judge Dillon's rule, and that is that this is back from the old days, and it's a very restrictive interpretation of municipal powers. And that's the general rule is that as a city, you have only those powers that are specifically given to you, or those which are absolutely essential to carry out your function, and any fair or reasonable doubt will be resolved against the city. Now, in Section 1, a sentence which only got in there by a one-vote margin at the Constitutional Convention, reads as follows: a liberal construction shall be given to the powers of local government units. And the precise purpose of this was to get away from Judge Dillon's rule. And they wanted our municipalities to have as much power as they needed to function as local government units. They didn't want them having to run to the legislature every session and saying, hey, we've got a problem we'd like to solve ourselves, but we don't have the power to do it. So here our court is not only going totally contrary to what our committee wanted on local government as far as the extent of powers, but also seeming to adopt Dillon's rule as a guide for even when home rule power would prevail. The opinion created a great deal of stir, and then the following year, a case came out of Juneau, and this was Macaulay v. Hildebrand. In this particular case, the city of Juneau and the unified city and borough of Juneau and continuing a battle which had started while I was on the assembly over centralized accounting with the school district. The city and borough decided to take up the battle again because a new charter required centralized accounting. Well, this is contrary to the statute. Question: does the statute prevail or does the home rule charter prevail? The city and borough went up on that and got trounced in a very short opinion, which made the local activities rule even more burdensome than ever, because they said, when you put Chugach and the Collie decision together, you find out that the only place in a municipality, a home rule municipality, has any power whatsoever is where the matter is one that's a purely local concern. And of course, in the other states that have used the state-local test that our drafters want to get away from, have commented that any time you wind up trying to show that something is purely local, you're going to lose. So essentially what we had after Macaulay was home rule powers which were just about built. And a brash, middle-aged law student at the University of Washington, enough outrage that he wrote an article for one of his classes. It was ultimately published in the UCLA Alaska Law Review. And I might say that had I had a little more time, I would have excised some of the less judicious language that I put in there. I was highly critical of our Supreme Court. I called them some very bad names. But anyway, there wasn't time to change it. They wanted to publish it immediately. It was published, and lo and behold, another case is coming out of Anchorage where the sewer power had been transferred to the borough. And Wilkie Jefferson was going in doing his thing again. And the home rule power issue was raised in that case. And the Supreme Court took that opportunity to, without saying we're changing our test, to say that we have a new test. We have the enunciating a new test, which is now an irreconcilable conflict test. Yeah, I think most of us were pretty happy when we saw the decision. I was thoroughly delighted. But I don't think we're out of the woods yet. Because I think, as I get a little further from that decision, it's probably about the best test they could have devised, although it's one that I had suggested in the article. I wish I'd taken a little more time now and perhaps thought through an even better test if they were going to take my suggestion. But we still have a problem, and I think it's a fairly serious problem, because that test, which they've now adopted, is relatively flexible. It can still be used for result-oriented decisions. That is, the court can still sit down and say, you know, as we all will unconsciously, gee, this is the way I think the decision ought to go. I think that the city has overstepped its bounds in this particular case. And that will tend to make us decide that, well, there's probably an irreconcilable conflict. So we don't really have a firm standard at this point. And I think part of the problem is that our local government committee maybe did go too far. And they said all legislative power is not prohibited. I like very much operating under a system which has all legislative power is not prohibited. But I think we have given the court a very difficult problem. One of the solutions could be legislative. That is, we could sit down with the legislature and ask them to expand and limit this, because they, after all, do have the power very clearly to prohibit certain functions. And I think it's very clear that the committee intended to put in the hands of the legislature the power to control home rule municipalities and to take it away from the courts. Therefore, I think we could possibly have a legislative resolution of this problem. But can the as I say, it's a very flexible test that could be defined in different ways depending on how the court perceives the state interest. If there's a greater state interest in a particular question, they may be considerably less willing to bend over backwards to make the two acts fit together. And that's what I suggest in my article, that they should not strike the ordinance unless there was just absolutely no way to make the two reconcilable. There's another problem. You could avoid the whole thing if the court would just say, well, this particular legislative act wasn't meant to apply to home rule municipalities. If it wasn't meant to apply to home rule municipalities, there can't possibly be any conflict. You can get around it very easily that way. But by the same token, they can find that there's such a statewide interest in this particular issue, that the legislature did mean it to apply to home rule municipalities. Now the suit couldn't put the two together. Very difficult, so the Home Rule Act may very well have to fall. Another problem is it's essentially a conflict-oriented standard, and this is one of the things that our committee wanted to get away from. This is one of the things that they use in the other states. They look at how serious the conflict is to determine whether the municipality has the authority to act. And our court has finally recognized now in the Jefferson B. State decision that our grant or the limitations are not ones of conflict, not ones of local interest, but ones of prohibition, and they have to find a prohibition. So I think we've got a difficult task ahead of us in getting the court to flesh out a reasonable rule and to apply it reasonably. But at the same token, I think maybe we just have an inherent problem. Very broad grant of home rule powers. With that, I'll terminate my comments and let Vic Fisher take a shot at me. One comment I on the Legislative Affairs Agency and what they're doing, the Community Regional Affairs now, used to be Legislative Affairs. When they were formed, as has already been mentioned, they had a very, very small.